Welcome to the Maris Review. I've been planning this episode for what, like a year and a half now? Elon Green is joining me. He has written for the New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, The New Yorker, and the Columbia Journalism Review, and appears in Unspeakable Acts, Sarah Wyman's anthology of true crime. He's been an editor at Longform since 2011, and his new book is called Last Call, A True Story of Love, Lust, and Murder in Queer New York. And I've been hearing about it for a long time, and I'm so thrilled to have him join me now. Hi.
Hey, Maris.
It's so good. We're doing this. I feel like we've talked about it for so long.
I am extremely excited.
Hey. Before we get into the case that you wrote about and the characters that you wrote about, I think the first thing I want to ask you about is that you wait until the acknowledgement, spoiler alert, to talk about how you first heard of this case. So tell me about the decision to not use the first person point of view in the book.
It was never anything that I considered because I'm so uninterested in my own role in the writing of the book. And in general, when writers bring themselves into books, I think it fails. Sometimes it can work, like the way David Grann brings himself into the last section of Killers of the Flower Moon, or it can work if the writer is actually part of the story. Mm-hmm. But I always felt that my role was as an observer, but also as basically a conduit for other people's recollections. So it would never have occurred to me to play any kind of role in the book unless I had to, which I do in the epilogue.
Sure. So let's go back and tell me how you first heard of this story, case, I don't know what to call it. It really stood out to me that in my own personal life, in the 90s, I was a sentient human being living near Asbury Park, probably reading the Asbury Park Press, probably aware of something. And yet I have no recollection of it, which speaks to how poorly it was covered or that I was too busy in high school drama at the time.
Well, the book was to some degree born out of a failed attempt at another book. I had tried to expand another story about some murders in San Francisco in the mid 70s called the Doodler Murders into a book. The idea that my agent and I hatched was that it would really be a history of the Castro in those years, and the murders would sort of be a backdrop. But once I realized that there was simply not enough material for that book, I figured I'd look for something else. But I wanted to explore the same issues of a community that was basically being screwed on a federal and local level, being extremely oppressed, and whose assaults and murders were not being taken very seriously. And so reading, I think it was a back issue of The Advocate, it was a story that was written when this case was cold, the Last Call case was cold, and I had never heard of the case. And after a short Google search, I figured out what it was and that it had been solved. And so I texted it to my friend Sarah Wyman, who knows more about true crime than anybody else. And I asked her if she had heard of the case. And when she hadn't, I immediately called our mutual agent, David Patterson.
Yeah, that's such a good sign for a book if Sarah hasn't heard about your subject matter. it struck me, one of the things you write again in the acknowledgments, because you don't talk about your role in the book, which I admire, was that there is no Wikipedia entry even for this case, which I find so shocking. And also it sounds so hard to come from the outside then and pull this thing together and see all of its angles. Tell me how you did that.
Well, there was a fair amount of existing material. Mm-hmm. There was, of course, the court transcript from when the murderer was convicted in 2005. And so that alone had a great deal of material, especially in establishing the bones of the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, I essentially had an open field because, you know, many of the people involved in the case on the investigative side, but also victims' family members and friends, were still alive. And nobody had called them, if at all, in 20 years. So when I called them, most of them were willing and eager to talk. And then, you know, once I'd been working on the story, the book, for a couple of years, especially going back even to the proposal stage, detectives just started giving me stuff.
Oh, interesting.
Almost nothing I relied on in the book came from official sources. My foils were rejected by Rockland County, New York, you know, the NYPD,
mm-hmm.
and New Jersey. You know, very little in the book was above board.
I love this element of true crime in your true crime. So tell me, like, I think we should back up. The series of murders you write about feel like a serial murder in some sort of TV show or something. Like, they're so lurid and they're so similar. There's a pattern. Like, I feel like that's the kind of thing we like to glorify in our entertainment, because it's, we have this idea that it's fun to enjoy smart, interesting serial killers.
I will say that I don't actually think the murderers are particularly lurid. I often think of something that a San Francisco detective said to me when I had described one of the murders as brutal. And he said to me, they're all brutal.
Hmm.
And I think that the reason that they come off particularly so in Last Call is because I actually take the time to describe what was done to the men.
Yes.
I think if you did that to just about every murder, just about, you know, every person who's been killed, it would feel that way. Because they're all destructive, no matter what the method is.
And then, of course, what was done to these men after they were killed is a whole other thing, too. Tell me about talking to the people who discovered these bodies. Did you talk to them, or were those?
Let me think. Yes, sometimes I did. When I could, I certainly tried to talk to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the man who's probably the most memorable of all the people who found the bodies is, I don't name him. His name is John. He's at the beginning of the book, and he was a maintenance worker. Hold on a second. Sure. Check that. It's been so long. I remember where I was when I interviewed him. Oh, yeah, okay. He was a maintenance worker in on a turnpike in Pennsylvania, and he's now a caterer, for what it's worth. And I was interviewing him over the phone while sitting on the floor of the New York Public Library. They refused to let me into a room to conduct the interview.
Oh, no.
And so we are having this discussion about him finding a dead body in a trash barrel as tourists are walking back and forth.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, he utters the line that people tend to stop on once they start the book, because he says, you know, describing opening each bag, you know, there were eight in all, and he says it looked like a loaf of bread, but then I saw freckles. And you know, every now and then in the book process somebody will say something to you where you sort of immediately know that it's memorable. And that was certainly the case.
And when you started your investigation and or the scope of writing this book, were all of the murders you describe already a part of the story?
Not really, or at least not to the degree that I made them. Fred Spencer, who was the victim in 1973, was literally just a sidebar in press coverage. There was very, very little already in the searchable, you know, public domain. I had to, you know, go pretty deep into the Bangor Daily News archives, and I interviewed associate attorneys involved in the case and the court stenographer. And then, you know, one of the other cases, which is an assault case from 1988 that resulted in a bench trial in Staten Island in 1990, that also was relegated to a sidebar, but luckily an enterprising court clerk in Ocean County found the transcript about a week before I was done with the proposal.
Wow.
And so she effectively gave me another 3,000 words to write about, because nobody had ever seen that transcript.
Tell me about the victims and what drew you to wanting to tell their stories in particular.
It was a number of things. Although it's not as if there was something extraordinary about any of them. And that was part of the attraction, actually, because everybody, no matter how famous or forgotten they are, is interesting if you look close enough.
Yeah.
And their lives have, you know, really fascinating arcs and you know, cross into some, you know, really interesting places and periods. And these guys were, you know, were from different professions, were different ages, came from different places, and had some really, you know, different experiences, and looked at as a whole, they really encompassed like gay life in those years. You know, some were in the closet, some were not. One was in the military, one was HIV positive. it was a chance to write about it all. But of course, once I started researching their lives, that's all I really wanted to do. It seemed to me that if there was going to be an engine for the book, it had to be them. I had so little interest in the murderer that in the proposal that was sold to Macmillan, there was no chapter on the murderer.
Interesting.
And I only wrote one out of narrative necessity.
That makes sense to me, having read the book. And yet it's what a great way to frame a true crime story, to be about the victims rather than the perpetrator.
I truly didn't give a shit, and I kind of and I mostly still don't. I had done a lot of research on him during the proposal, the year I worked on the proposal. So I had it, and then I was given a binder which was used in preparation for the murder trial, which relied on his personal calendar, work calendar, credit card records, and vacation slides. And it was effectively giving me a timeline of his entire life. So once I had that, I could more or less put a chapter together on him, which I needed to do to fill in, a gap of about 6 years when the case had gone cold.
Mm-hmm. But you're more, you're primarily interested in this time in New York City that seems like it was lifetimes ago, but it wasn't. When being queer in the West Village and Chelsea was
a risk,
that's the best way to say it. And that it took me for you to say that AIDS affected this community like nothing else, but I didn't think about how the public's perception of AIDS and the propaganda about it would make New York City at that time more violent.
Yeah, I mean, I have memories of that period and about that period in the epidemic. I remember being in school and, hearing that AIDS was transmissible via toilet seats. That was sort of taken for granted. Of course, we learned about Ryan White.
Yep.
But working on this book gave me a much greater sense of how much worse everything was than I knew, or even knew years later. And being able to make that connection between the epidemic and the violence that was being perpetrated on queer New Yorkers was startling.
And even when, we know that is the most, the crime was up in the 80s and 90s, and still it surprised me to hear this. And so much of it, of course, is because you can't call the cops in 1991 if you're a gay man who's been the victim of a hate crime.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember who said it to me, but I think it was probably a staff member of the Anti-Violence Project. They said, people didn't bother going to the cops in the early 80s because assaulting a queer person wasn't a crime.
Yeah. And so how do you even begin to account for the numbers of people who are hurt if you can't even report it? Tell me about the AVP and the radicalization that was necessary in the area because violence just wasn't being addressed.
Yeah, so I wrote a chapter about the Anti-Violence Project because I felt that, and I should say the Anti-Violence Project was an organization that was, you know, started in the early 80s as a way to get the NYPD in particular, to try to convince them to take, you know, anti-queer violence seriously, which, as I said, they did not.
They did not.
And, you know, AVP is sort of tangentially involved in the story of the last call murders. But I felt that they were involved just enough that it made sense to just pull away a bit. Sorry. pull away a bit from the narrative and to give readers a sense of the backdrop of what was going on in New York and, quite frankly, the stakes and why the queer community was so angry at how the case was being handled. And the only way to really do that was to tell the story of why AVP came about in the first place.
Yeah.
And that was a really interesting, difficult chapter to work on because so little of its history has been traditionally preserved.
Right.
And also, they refused to cooperate with me.
Oh, interesting. Okay. That makes sense.
You know, even and the history that they present is incomplete to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I, you know, like I was given a tip basically early on in the research, for example, that the original director was a former nun named Rebecca Porper,
right,
who, you know, worked at Union Theological Seminary. And she's effectively been written out of their history. And so when I called her up, she was just tickled. And I spent, you know, months just piecing together its rise as an organization, you know, from an apartment in Chelsea to, you know, the office they eventually occupied in what is now the LGBT Center in Manhattan. You know, and I interviewed a lot of the former executive directors and staffers and found bits and pieces about, you know, their accomplishments in the LGBT Center Library. You know, Thomas Duane, you know, famous gay lawmaker who represented Chelsea, had a bit about the organization in his papers, which he had donated. And, you know, of course, while the murders were happening, they were very vocal about how badly they were being investigated. And so there was a little bit of that narrative thread that I could work into the chapter.
Let's take a step back again and talk about more about the scene that was going on in the 80s and 90s, especially the piano bars that you talk about. Like, I certainly in this pandemic, the idea of going to Marie's Crisis and singing show tunes drunkenly around a piano sounds like heaven.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, again, this was one of those things where material that I thought was going to be there just simply wasn't. And to this day, I don't know why there hasn't been that much written about these bars.
Yeah.
I think it's because so much of what has been written about queer life in New York in the early 90s, late 80s, is through the prism of AIDS. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't really occur to anybody to treat the bars and clubs as bars and clubs where people would congregate to have fun, even mm-hmm. amid a pandemic and an epidemic. And so luckily, there were still existing sources of information mm-hmm. like Matthew Bank, who was the founding editor of a publication called HX, which was a bar rag, primarily a gay bar rag. And he gave me, stacks of it. And it was, basically an easy way to figure out, where all these bars were, and allowed me to give a sense of the layout of the bar scene in those years. Because many of these bars simply didn't leave a trace historically.
Which I feel like, especially in the media that I consume about New York City now, where every place seems to have like a fandom and like people who want to remember what's happened there and be a part of its history.
And the thing is those people still exist. They just don't necessarily have an outlet to mm-hmm. discuss these bars. I found many bar regulars, not just for New York bars, but for the chapter where I write about mm-hmm. bars in Philadelphia,
yep.
just by tweeting, are there any regulars from the Blue Parrot, circa 1991? And
wow.
I would hear from people.
That's incredible. And of course, one of the main characters, I'd say, in this book is Rick Unterberg, who was the pianist at a bar called the Townhouse in the East 50s. It seems like you must have a line to him.
Oh, Rick and I spent a fair amount of time together, at his apartment, at the Townhouse. I went to the Townhouse a lot, especially when I wasn't doing any reporting, because I loved it there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just found it so relaxing. It was also kind of a pleasant novelty to be hit on, which doesn't ever happen anywhere else.
Right.
But there was nothing better than settling back with a glass of Jameson and listening to Rick play for a couple of hours. And he was such a willing participant in the book. I would almost say more of a co-conspirator than anything else.
Aww.
He, like many of the sources I had, felt he had a real personal stake in the book being good.
Mm-hmm.
And, he was always more bullish on the book's prospects for becoming a movie, and always said, I would like to be played by Tom Cruise. And it's upsetting that he's not around to see where things stand.
I'm so sorry about that. And all right, let's not talk anymore about that, because I don't want to, I don't know if it, calling it a spoiler doesn't seem right, but you set this scene of this time in New York City in the early 90s when the AIDS epidemic is destroying the community entirely. There is increased violence. And then on top of all of the other horrifying things going on, there is an actual killer on the loose. Tell me about Rick's and other people's experiences, if you ask them about it. Like socializing and wanting to feel.
The thing with these murders, mm-hmm. and you know, it's one of the reasons why people don't remember them, is that when 11,000 people are being diagnosed with AIDS in a year, as I think they were in New York, and I believe it was 1991, the fact that there's a murder happening in, you know, maybe once every 10 months or 12 months doesn't really register. Mm-hmm. You know, from as Rick, you know, once memorably put it, like, it didn't really affect the two murders of men at from the townhouse didn't really affect the ebb and flow of the bar because, you know, they were tourists. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they weren't missed. And, you know, I think that, the, you know, the bigger picture of gay life in New York was so bleak during that period that the fact that there was a serial killer targeting these men was kind of an afterthought. You know, I only met a single person during the reporting of this book who wasn't directly or even tangentially involved with the case, who knew about it. And obviously, I interviewed many gay men who were adults and living in Manhattan during those years. It simply did not catch anyone's attention, and for very good reason.
And so along the lines of the police completely letting down the Chelsea and West Village communities, there's this murderer who kills gay men, and it's hard to get that to the top of the NYPD's priorities list at that time.
Well, not just the NYPD's priorities mm-hmm. list, but even the communities.
Sure.
You know, it's sort of like spilling a glass of water on yourself in the middle of a rainstorm. Mm-hmm. You're not going to really feel it. Quite frankly, you know, looking back on it now, I'm shocked that it got as much attention as it did. And I think it only happened because it was New York and because Margaret Mulcahy, the wife of the second victim, was so vocal about wanting these murders to be solved.
Because once again, you're dealing with, if justice comes from family members being active and angry and vocal, then that makes it extra difficult if so many of the men who died were at least partially closeted.
Absolutely. You know, for me, Margaret was as close to a hero as the book has because she kept at it, and not everybody did. Not everybody had advocates.
You do eventually find a perpetrator. The stories line up. He was convicted of some stuff.
Two of the murders, the ones in New Jersey.
Two of the murders. But you don't spend a lot of time on him.
Part of it is as I say, I'm just not interested. Yeah. But also, he never confessed. To this day, even in letters he sends from prison, he denies any culpability. And also, just in general, motive doesn't tend to really factor into serial murder cases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by the time you're killing upwards of a half dozen people at least, you're just doing it because you like it. So, to the extent that I was interested in him eventually, it was only because I felt that, you know, he was probably under some of the same societal pressures as his victims.
Mm-hmm.
But he obviously handled it differently and made different choices.
Thank you, Elon. This has been so enlightening and so terrifying and sad too. Before we go, everyone should read Last Call, especially if you're like me and have lived in New York a long time and you think you know everything or partly everything or something, and you basically just know nothing. That's my blur. Elon, tell me what you've been reading before we say goodbye.
Right now, I am reading Sarah Shulman's forthcoming History of ACT UP, New York.
Have you found overlap?
To some degree. ACT UP is mentioned only once in my book, mainly in passing in the Anti-Violence Project chapter. But no, I mean, hers is such a thorough, insanely so, history that, yeah. The other book is The Believer by Abe Riesman, his biography of Stan Lee. And I'm loving both of them. I no longer have the patience to read anything I don't like.
That's what a wonderful point to get to. I'm still learning.
Well, luckily, you know, my job, to the extent that I have one, doesn't require that I do that.
Thank you. Elon Green, thank you so much. This was such a joy.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review. And check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.